So, hey, everyone, I am bringing Kyle onto the channel today. Kyle is the co-founder and VP of client services for Weller Healthcare IT. So Weller Healthcare offers comprehensive staffing solutions for a variety of healthcare services and healthcare providers that are facing lots of ongoing pressures that we have. And their staffing services include, of course, medical coding, auditing, education, CDI, medical billers, scanners, chart retrieval, HIM, and advisory. And Weller is committed to providing world-class consulting services at a reasonable cost. So, Kyle, thank you so much for coming on. It's been a little bit, over a year, I think, since I last had you on. And there's just constantly so much good feedback from that I thought, you know, we both kind of convened that it would be a good idea to do this again.
Yeah, I was thrilled that you reached out. I've had a lot of positive feedback. I know I remarked to you before that probably on a weekly basis, I have people reaching out and saying, you know, it was helpful. It's just good to get the tips in general from somebody who's in this space day in, day out. You know, for me, I'm dealing with people working with jobs, you know, every single day. They're working to get the position. They're looking to change positions. They're just seeing what's out in the market. Maybe it's their first position. That was kind of where our video focused the first time. And yeah, it's all been positive feedback. I think the more that I can share, the better, because my job is dealing with helping candidates find positions. And that's all I do every day. You know, normally people are just focused on their job at hand, right? And it might not be helping the staff. It's usually coding, right? Let's say it's coding. So anything that they can get about my world, so that when it actually comes time for them to look for that job, I want to arm them with just a few little tidbits here and there. And I appreciate you giving me the platform to do so.
Yeah, absolutely. So Kyle, you've had like years of experience working with and recruiting lots of different revenue cycle professionals, especially medical coders, right? Which is what this channel is a little bit more geared towards. What are some of the most important qualities or skills that you look for when you're recruiting medical coders? And then why is that so important?
Sure. Yeah. I think the biggest thing is somebody like myself, when I was recruiting or for my recruiters, you're going to have to be able to find that person, right? So I think the biggest number one thing is getting yourself out there. You know, we all can't be extroverts. Yes, I get that. But at the end of the day, if you do not check certain boxes, then it's simply that a recruiter is not going to find you. And if they're not going to find you, then they can't then help you and put you into the job that they have. You know, because at this day and age, the market for coding positions, they're everywhere. You know, whether you're qualified for them or not is a different story that we can get into later. But in terms of there being open opportunities, it's there. So my biggest advice is several things. I won't go too deep into the resume because we did that in our first video that you can go back and find. But to just keep it short and sweet, try to have your resume to be one page as much as you can. If you want a cover letter, sure. I personally don't recommend them. People just want to get to the facts. And if you can make it one page, depending on how long your career has been, try to shorten it to one page, maybe two pages at the most. I suggest education at the end. I would say experience in the middle. And I would say a brief summary in your credentials as a coder, even if it's an apprentice credential, regardless. Your credentials up at the top with your name, summary, meat and potatoes of your experience in the middle, education at the bottom. If it can be one page, the hiring managers or whomever is looking, in this case, recruiters, right, getting yourself out there, they're going to give it, 10, 15 seconds. I don't know what the industry standard is. I've heard seven. I might be a little longer on my side, maybe a little slower to read, but I like to get in there and see what I can. But, you know, 3-4 bullets in each of those pieces of job experience. So when you have your job title, the dates you were there, and the company you were working for, try to have 3-4 bullets. So number one, yeah. Make sure it's a good resume that's easy to read. If it's too lengthy, you might even get passed on. So you want to make it short and concise. The next thing is try to get that out to the job boards. Indeed is very popular. Seems to be a very good one. Obviously, you have some of your originals, which is Career Builder and Monster. I think those obviously are good too. Everyone goes on those three all the time. I think another thing to do is your LinkedIn profile. If you have a LinkedIn profile, I would utilize it. And by that, I mean making connections with recruiters. It's very easy to do a Google search, you know, famous or popular or well-known staffing vendors for medical coding. You know, 10 or 15 mm-hmm. are going to pop up. I highly suggest you choose Weller first, but that's just me. You're going to want to go and in LinkedIn, you can search Weller. You can search any of our other competitors. There's plenty out there. And it's going to start bringing up a list of the people that work there. So once you've established your LinkedIn profile, start connecting with all the recruiters at all the major, you know, list 10 of the staffing vendors that you find. Then go find them on LinkedIn after your profile is set up. Go and find the recruiters. Go and connect with each and every one of them. You can write them a little message. Hey, I'm looking. You know, this is getting yourself out there, right? And if your LinkedIn profile doesn't mirror your resume exactly, yeah, there's little tweaks you could do. You could put in your social media. For example, the first video that we did, I have on my profile. So if someone goes on my LinkedIn profile, you're going to see my experience. Yes, just like a resume. You're going to start to see my connections. You're going to start to see my activity. You're going to want to post on people's walls. You're going to want to become active with maybe recommendations of colleagues, anything that's going to start getting the algorithm going and your profile up at the top so it can be seen in your connections with the recruiters. And I think finally, in order to get yourself out there, would be with Facebook. The Facebook groups has definitely become extremely popular in the last couple of years. There's some that I would say have, last time I checked, about 25,000 members in some of the larger ones. And that's a whole lot of people. They can be utilized for many different things. They can be used for coding questions and coding queries. I see a lot of people in there without showing PHI information and getting yourself in trouble. There's certain questions you can ask, and you have all the coders in there, 25,000 people that are able to come in and comment. But you're also going to see recruiters posting jobs in all of these mm-hmm. groups. So just go to Facebook, go to groups. It's a whole section. You can type in medical coding, and you're going to start to see them all pop up. So when you get on there, it's very easy to see who the common people are that are responding consistently. And mm-hmm. those people are well known. They're in your face. So if one of their resumes came across my desk, oh, I already know this person. I see them commenting on the Facebook groups. I've seen their LinkedIn profile. I see them commenting on LinkedIn. They've reached out to my recruiters before. So I think, long story short, making yourself visible and getting yourself out there is the number one thing you can do to be recognized. And this is the polar opposite of just taking your resume, putting it on the job board, and sitting back and waiting.
Yeah,
it's a very competitive market these days. And so that's my biggest suggestion, is taking those steps to get yourself in front of people. You becoming progressive with it, and you being proactive with it, I think is the key.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting the way these Facebook groups have progressed, because there's some that I see that aren't even very active, but people are so drawn to them that they've got like tens of thousands of you know, people that are in the group, even though maybe there's only a couple of posts going a day. And I'm glad that you touched on that the recruiters are in there and posting jobs, and that you're not necessarily, you know, checking into the details of people's personal lives and what they're doing, but you're familiar with the names. So if someone came up that was a name that you saw, oh yeah, they're in there and they're helping, they seem like to be an industry expert, that's going to pop up in your memories. Or on the contrary, it might be if you see someone who's a jerk to everyone on the Facebook groups all the time, that's, you know, true. That might be up in there too. And people think that, you know, they're very anonymous on there, but if you're posting on there, sometimes, you know, people pick up on things.
Yeah, they see.
Yeah. So now, as far as like the kind of jobs that are out there, what are you seeing as far as where they're coming from? Are we seeing a lot more hospitals, a lot more provider groups, private practices, insurance company, software vendors? Like, where are the most common jobs that are out there?
So, good question. So I would say your hospitals and your health systems, absolutely. This could be an individual hospital that's in a major city. It could be a larger health system in a major city, or maybe it's across several states in your region. You know, take Banner, for example, in Arizona. You know, they have many different locations. I would consider that a health system. Lots of jobs coming out of there, all the way from your inpatient coder, same-day surgery, ED, OBS, prophy, etc. The health systems are going to have it. The other thing you're going to see is these larger services companies. They're not just hiring coders. They're also going to be hiring chart visualists. They're going to be doing many different things. They're going to be selling software to the hospitals. But organizations like Conifer, Tenet, for example, you know, they own and operate something around 100 hospitals, right? So companies like this, where you're not necessarily going to the health system anymore or the hospital directly anymore, but you're going into this owned entity that is operating and managing up to 100 hospitals. So they're doing a ton of hiring too. You're going to see your provider groups like your WellMeds and your WellCares. Those are primarily going to be prophy positions, your HCC coder positions as well. Your insurance companies, we definitely see the insurance companies hiring directly too, a lot more on the HCC risk adjustment side, sometimes prophy.
Yeah.
And you're going to go into another realm, which is organizations that have created encoders or artificial intelligence or natural language processors, NLP type companies. And they've created that software that they are essentially like an IT company that have built this software, and they're often selling it. Well, what happens is when they sell that software, let's say they sell it to an insurance company, the insurance company say, oh, this is fantastic. Thank you. We also don't have enough coders for this. We would like you to not only give us the software, but go ahead and give us some coders as well. So then they start looking too. So that across the board for coding, I find that a lot of CDI, you're going to have your inpatient CDI with those hospitals, health systems, and the larger owned entities like Tenet. You're going to see the outpatient CDI with the provider groups as well. That's pretty big. And then everything that I just mentioned is definitely going to have your auditors. So anybody that's in the QA realm, and then you're also going to have your educators too. And the educators could be for coding staff to teach them. And a lot of times it could be related to CDI, where it could be teaching of the providers and the physicians. And I would say 99% of this all is still remote. It's primarily remote. So it's pretty widespread, a lot of different places. And that's not to say the staffing vendors too. The staffing vendors. So not only could you go direct to all of these places, you can go direct to the hospitals, the health systems. They have websites where you can go to their open jobs. You can see their open jobs on the job boards, but also all the staffing vendors. So any of these locations that have partnered with a staffing vendor like us, they'll give us the jobs while they're usually looking themselves. So if I were you, you know, it's consistently on the job boards, on the Facebook groups, like we mentioned before, on LinkedIn. I mean, these are all very viable places to look, and lots of different types of organizations are still hiring, and I don't see it slowing down.
Yeah. So there's a couple of interesting things that I picked up. So you're saying like the overwhelming majority of these jobs that you're seeing are remote, which I think is interesting, because the AAPC recently did their kind of membership survey, and they said that they reported that only about 55% of their members are working remotely. Now, some are in like a hybrid situation, but that seemed like a very low number to me. And I'm wondering if it's because it was not just coders and like auditors, it was also maybe practice managers and billers or something thrown in there that was driving that number up. But just, that just seemed like a low number to me, 55% saying that they're working remotely.
That's extremely low. I would say is probably this. Another way to look at it too is, are we talking contract positions or full-time positions? And what I mean by full-time is you're a full-time employee. So you are, let's say that the hospital, for example, let's say Mayo, Mayo has hired you. You are a Mayo employee. They're the ones paying you. You're on their benefits. I could see how a lot of times your full-time positions could still be on site. I think that it is slowly transitioning. I mean, I think COVID helped a lot, but I think a lot of these organizations are realizing, yes, they're full-time employees. Yes, we have a off-campus office building for them to go to work at. I know Baptist here in Jacksonville has a lot of their coding staff that are in a different building. It's in a strip mall, basically, and a lot of them are housed there. So I could see that. I guess I should differentiate that a majority of the jobs that you're going to see the vendors get, and if you are looking to go into the contract world, I would say that's primarily 95% or higher, as I said, remote. Probably your direct hire, your full-time employee, I could see that being a little over half. That's probably a true statement.
Okay. And then the other thing is you talked about how, you know, we have a lot of software vendors that are hiring coders or developing software that has AI elements or elements to help kind of guide us to the right code or facilitate maybe the coding to be done in a little bit more of a faster capacity. And there's a lot of, you know, panic around that in the industry. Oh my gosh, you know, especially with, I've actually banned the word from the comments in my channel because I'm so tired of hearing about it, but ChatGPT. And people think, oh, well, this is just going to replace all of the medical coders. And I think there is going to be some element of just not elimination of coders, but it's going to make our jobs more meaningful. It's going to make us have to think a lot more. We're going to be able to look at things at a deeper way than maybe we didn't previously in that more QA aspect, in that more auditing aspect, not necessarily just, well, this diagnosis is this. It's going to make our jobs either more efficient or more meaningful because we're going to be able to look at a deeper dive of what's going on and are things being reported accurately?
Sure. Yeah. To me, the AI within this industry is not new. I would say probably 7 years ago, I sat down and I was able to look at an AI software. Right? They were calling it AI. What that software was doing is a medical record would open. It would read everything for the coder. It would get all the way down to where the coder needed to apply a code. And it was a very long record. So it scrolled through maybe 60 pages and it stopped. And it said to the coder, here is an opportunity. You know, this is a software, this AI software saying, I've read the record. Here's an opportunity for you. And do you agree with it or not? Well, the human factor there is that the AI still could not determine at 100% whether or not this was a true opportunity or not. It believed it to be, but it still needed the human mind to say, yes, it is. Then furthermore, if they said yes, then it would say, okay, now that you've said yes, I think it's probably one of these five codes. And I need you to tell me which of these five codes it is. So the coder was still there giving that reasoning, that human reasoning that we are so famous for, right? And I don't see it to where it's going to completely take over the job. I mean, if you just look at the rebuttal process in coding, for example, the back and forth that a coder could have with the auditor, the coder is saying, well, I'm definitely right because of X, Y, and Z. And the auditor is saying, well, no, I'm right because of X, Y, and Z. And it's this back and forth tit for tat in the rebuttal process. That's not something that an AI could do. So I think if you had that AI, you're probably going to be leaving reimbursement on the table. It's not going to be as highly specified as a human coder could be. So I think whomever in the day and age decides to go completely AI, I think they're going to be leaving money out. And I think a person still needs to be the one that can choose the highest specificity of a particular code in a particular instance to bring in the revenue. So I know we're off on a tangent, but I don't see it replacing us anytime soon.
Yeah. Well, just thank you. Let me bring it back then. One of the most common questions I get from my viewers is, my newer coders, the ones that have their CPCAs, they're looking for that first position, and they're out there, they're applying to a lot of places, and they say, well, why can't I find a job? And it could be any variety of reasons. I don't know all of my viewers personally. It could be because, they're putting irrelevant information on their resume. It could be they're applying for jobs that they're not suited for. Like maybe they have a CPC and they don't realize the difference between professional fee coding and inpatient, and they're applying for inpatient positions. It could even be they're applying for work for home positions in local areas that don't have them. They could have a criminal record. It could be any myriad of reasons, without personally sitting down and diving into them, what they're doing. So what are some of the top reasons that you see that are preventing new coders from finding jobs? And is there anything that they could do to kind of improve their chances?
Yeah, absolutely. Increasing their chances, I'll kind of take on the back end. I think first and foremost, you hit on a couple solid points. I'd say if you're new and you're just getting into this industry, you need to educate yourself on the differences between AAPC versus AHIMA. Definitely educate yourself on the differences between facility coding, outpatient coding, risk adjustment coding. Differentiate yourself between whether or not I'm going to be a multi-specialty pro fee coder, or if I'm going to be a dermatology coder, or I'm going to be a family medicine, internal medicine coder, and if I go same day surgery, am I also going to do observation? If I'm ED, my ED facility, do I know my E&M leveling? If I'm inpatient, is it for a community hospital of 200 beds? Is it for trauma facilities? Is it for academic facilities? Is it not, there's so many different intricacies, and there's many different places you can educate yourself on this. I mean, AAPC and AHIMA will give it to you, but also a place like Your Videos. I mean, it's a shameless plug, I should say, but it's going through them. I mean, the fact that we have this stuff at our fingertips, Google, you could even use the chat feature that we were just talking about, that you had a delete that we won't speak its name, but you could even type in there and it's going to tell you. So, we have these features now where everything online, YouTube videos, your channel, you can start to break it down. So when you're applying to the jobs, I would not suggest, if you're a new coder, applying to a inpatient trauma level one facility coder position. Unfortunately, the reality of the situation is your resume will not get looked at. They will likely not give you an opportunity for that job. And the reason is there's a lot of money on the line, sometimes millions of dollars on the line, that they need someone to go in and start capturing codes for that reimbursement. So stick to where you are. If you're an entry-level coder, you have to go after entry-level jobs. It's as simple as that. I suggest always to people, if you are going to go after something that's higher level, try to go just one step above. And what I mean by that is this: if you've had 3 or 4 years of coding experience, it's okay to go after a coding lead job. That's not a problem, because a lot of times as a coding lead, that's one step up. If you've been a coding lead, or if you've been a coding supervisor, and a auditor role opens up and you've dabbled here and there, I would definitely suggest, okay, that's one step up. So always going one step above, I think, is fine. But I think if you are out there and you are just posting your resume anywhere it can go, you're not going to get a lot of love. People aren't going to be reaching out to you if it's not at least the exact same position, or it's one that's one tier up, I think, that you can work yourself into. And in terms of not hearing anything when you reach out, I'm going to go back to what we first talked about. It's about being proactive. Hospitals, when they get on their job boards, or a medical group or insurance company or a staffing vendor, when they post on the jobs, you are going to get an insane amount of applications, right? Those applicants aren't necessarily differentiating themselves between each other as just applying online. But if someone applied online to a weather job and then they went on to LinkedIn and found me or found the recruiter on LinkedIn and messaged us and say, hey, I saw the job opening that you had. I'm really, really interested in this. I applied 2 days ago. You know, here's why I would be good for this job. Boom, 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 boom. So you're taking the, you're going above and beyond everybody else. And in today's market, that certainly needs to happen. And it's not that hard to find people's email addresses either. You know, if you know the corporation, a trick of the trade is you can just Google the name of the company and email structure.
Right.
And it's going to tell you, you know, first dot last at weatherhit.com. Well, if you know my first and last name, Kyle.Johnston. So now instead of sending me a LinkedIn message and I might not get to until tomorrow or the next day, now you're emailing me and I get those on my phone. I mean, as does everyone, I'll see your email immediately. So I would say stick to, you know, don't get too far ahead of yourself. If you're an entry-level coder, you can get to inpatient. It's just going to take a while. You can't just skip everybody in line. It's not going to happen. They're not going to review. You're not qualified for it. They're going to move on. So stick into your area, maybe one notch above, and then start taking the initiative to email and LinkedIn message people when you apply to their jobs. You know, if it goes into a job posting and it goes to HR, it might go into a black hole that goes on forever and no one notices anything. Yeah. So that's my biggest advice, is get yourself out there.
Absolutely. No, I love that. Now, when we're talking about, you know, you've gotten their resume and you're kind of evaluating them, how do you evaluate a candidate's experience or their qualifications in medical coding? And what are some of the common like mistakes or red flags that you see as far as like discrepancies in their work history or experience that they've said they've had? Or discrepancies even on their resume, because I've had in my previous experience, you know, because I've worked in management and stuff. I'll have people that say, "Oh yeah, I've done coding. I've coded charts before. I coded for such and such." And then when you kind of like sit down and talk to them, they were maybe more so working in charge entry, but because they maybe tweaked a code here or there, they thought, "Oh well, that's coding," and I'll just tell them that I'm a coder. So how do you kind of identify some of those discrepancies in their experience and their work history?
Sure. So that's pretty good. I think that goes back into applying like our last topic. I would say if you've been in charge entry and you're trying to make a leap to a coder, I think honesty is the best policy, 100%. I would be honest and don't necessarily try to tweak yourself into the coder. You know, be honest with what the position was. And then be honest about how your objective is trying to become a coder and why you're good for that is because X, Y, and Z, while I was in charge entry, here's the overlap that I had. And then based on this other experience that I have, here's why I'm now ready to make the jump into becoming a coder and why I would be good at it. So I think honesty is always the way to go. I think you might be able to slip past a couple people, but eventually it's going to catch up to you if you're trying to tweak your resume too much and the experience is just not valid. So when we do look at those resumes, and let's say you do have the experience for it, let's say you were in charge entry going for a charge entry role, or you are a coder going into a new coding role, and I would take this across any industry, it's just a staffing generality here, is you're going to want to show what you did for that company in your two or three bullet points. So I'll give you an example. If I was an inpatient coder at a large hospital, I might say, first bullet point, when I walked in the door, they had a DNFB of $5 million, right? So they had a stack of charts piled up, well, in their EMR, let's just say, and it's not been coded. You were hired in, you're so good, you're so efficient, and you're so accurate that you were able to get through that $5 million worth of charts that hadn't been coded yet in 6 months and increase the revenue of that hospital for $5 million. If that's your first bullet point, they're not going to read past the next bullet point. They've read that and they said, whoa, you know, this is my exact problem. I've got $2 million worth of charts that I haven't touched yet. If it's, you know, a supervisor role and you're going for the manager role, you know, first bullet point, was responsible for, you know, bringing in new hires, Out of all these new hires, you know, every single one of them stayed onto the company for 5 years or more after they went through my training program. You know, any coding questions, I answered their coding questions so well that the director told me to create a training program to then train everyone in the hospital for it. You know, what you're really doing is you're being honest, but you're specifically speaking to how you made the last position better, how you either made your employees better or you made the company more money, the revenue. So always stick to those exact facts, because when you're going out for the next job, that's what they want to see. What's this person going to do when they come in to my organization? And if they're going to do that for us, then, you know, that's the person that I want. And I would say biggest red flag, I mean, if it's a very wordy resume, like we went on again, people really don't have the time to read all the way through it. You know, if they've only got one or two applicants that they're deciding between, sure, they'll probably read every page. But when it comes to them receiving 10, 50, 100, 150 resumes sometimes, the more concise you can be, the better. And in those bullet points, making sure that they are saying things of that nature. I think one thing would be tenure. You cannot get away from only having 6 months at a job, 6 months at a job, 6 months at a job. If you're a contractor, right? So if you're doing contract work, a lot of times we hire contractors as a staffing vendor to work for our clients, which are hospitals. You're probably not going to get away from 6 months, 6 months, 6 months, 6 months. So what you're going to want to make sure you do is not only list the staffing vendor that you worked for, but also the hospital or provider group or where they assigned you to. And you can specifically say on contract through XYZ. Now, if you're a full-time employee, and it's 6 months, 6 months, 6 months, 6 months, that is going to raise a red flag. So I would highly suggest speaking on why that happened. It doesn't necessarily matter what the reason is, but I would definitely address it, because that's going to be something that a hiring manager sees, and it's going to be one of the first things they pick up on. You're going to see how long you were at your last role, and they're going to keep going down. If the first one's 2 years and the next one's 2 years, no problem. If it's shorter than a year consistently, it's fine. Just make sure that you have an answer for why it happened. The other big red flag would probably be any large gaps in the resume. I know that people are very consumed with having a massive gap in there. I think if you leave the gap and you don't say anything, it can raise a red flag. Not always. Some hiring managers, they might not care, but I would say a majority of the time, it's going to be an alarming thing when there's no reason. So I would say just own up to it. Again, honesty is the best policy. And I've seen now recently, people will start to put in from this date to this date, I had no work history because I was taking care of my elderly parents, because I was a stay-at-home dad, stay-at-home mom. I was a caregiver. You know, it doesn't matter, whatever it is. I sold the company and I made a lot of money.
I think that's certainly a great idea, because I know some people have asked me that in the past, and I've not had a good solution for it other than we'll just have something planned when you get that interview to say. Yeah. And no, I like the idea of kind of giving that span and saying why it is. So just so that people aren't thinking, oh, well, is there something that they did during that time that they want to hide? Like, were they at some job they don't want to disclose to us? You know, were they maybe, you know, incarcerated? What, you know, what was going on?
Yeah. So just it's, as long as you put it in there, they're going to see, they won't see the gap. So it's no longer an issue. You know, when you see the gap, your brain's always, oh, something's missing here. And then you start running wild. What could it be? Oh, I wonder what happened, blah, 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 blah. So if it's listed in there, whenever I see that, I go, oh yeah, that makes sense. And then I just keep on moving down. So it becomes a mute point. So that's my suggestion. Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, I also loved your idea of, you know, quantifying your accomplishments on your resume. So not just listing basically a bulleted point reason of what your job description was, but also saying something about what did I accomplish when I was here? Could I code X amount of charts an hour? Did I get the of cash that was sitting in a work queue down to almost nothing? You know, being able to really accentuate what you specifically did, not just necessarily what your job you know, description said you were supposed to be doing.
Yes. Yeah. Don't take the job description and put it in there. If someone's hiring you for a role that you have been doing and it's your career, they're going to know what your role is. They know what your day to day, you know, that's a given. So what makes you different than the next resume they're going to look at? You know, yeah, I cleared this DNFB, or I created a training program, or I was at 95% accuracy longer than any other coder in the history of my organization. I had the longest streak of accurate, let's just say, right? You know, yeah, or my production was so high, I was the most productive and accurate coder of a team of 25 people for 2 years running, but whatever it is. But that is how we differentiate resumes from another. And now, of course, there's pre-screening steps that go beyond that, coding tests and interviews and things. But mm-hmm. this is more about how to get yourself even to that stage.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was glad to hear you talk about, you know, the job hopping. I think more people are going from job to job, but there is a huge difference between you're going from job to job every 6 months versus every 2 years.
Yes.
One of the more recent things that's been growing in popularity is this concept, though, of like rage applying, where you just apply to all the positions you can possibly find because you're just, you know, frustrated at your work situation.
Yeah.
And they're just mad and applying to whatever they can find. And, you know, sometimes people do, because of that, wind up finding positions that pay more. So that might be maybe why some people are jumping, you know, from every 6 months versus every 2 years. Sure. Do you think that there's steps, though, that coders should take before they hit that point where they're like, oh, I'm so frustrated, I'm just going to go out and apply to every job that I can find?
Yes. I think, you know, first and foremost, it's identifying what the root issue is. Mm-hmm. I have found that it's usually one of two things. Usually. So put that asterisk out there. Of course, it could be many other things. But what I find is two primary components. The first is you're not working well with your colleagues. Let's say this colleague over here annoys you because of X, Y, and Z, and you've just had enough. This is just too much for me. So if you identify that that's the root problem, first and foremost, I would go to HR. Those things need to remain confidential. Usually in your conversations with HR, you can actually say, I want this to remain confidential. And you can speak on it. I mean, it's human resources. That is why they're there. There should be a human resources department at your company. So if it's a colleague problem, you know, address it with HR. They're going to go through those appropriate steps with you. I think the second thing is just going to be money. You know, we all want to find a job that we love. I know you love yours. Very passionate about what you do. I do love mine. We all have our hard days, but to put it in very simple terms, we get paychecks, right? The bigger the paychecks, the better it is for us. So we want more money. And if we're out there hearing that there's other people in similar positions earning more money, that's going to cause a problem. You know, why not me? Why am I not getting paid that? Could I leave here and go earn that type of money? So I think the first thing you're going to want to do is you might not know that that's on the table for you where you work currently if you haven't asked. So I would easily, I know I keep saying go on Google or go do this, but it's very easy to find what the common salary is for your position. So if you're saying, you know, I'm a coder level two, I'm a coder level two outpatient same-day surgery coder, you know, you can type that in and see what the national average is for your salary. Whatever the salary comes up to, if you want to know what it is for hourly, just divide it by 2080. That's 2080. And when you divide your salary by 2080, it's going to give you your hourly amount. So once you have your salary and your hourly amount of what the national average is, if you're earning under that, then you can take those facts and you can bring it to your direct report. So whether that's your supervisor, manager, director, whatever it is, and you can say, hey, listen, I would be prepared to say, the national average for my salary is X, Y, and Z. I've been working here for 2 years in this position, doing very well. Here's my accuracy scores, my production. Here's how well I've been doing, and I'm currently underpaid. I'm requesting that we match what the national average is. So I would definitely come prepared to that conversation of why you deserve an increase and where everyone else is. Now, if the answer is no, by all means, there's certainly opportunity for you out there. I highly suggest new coders. It's going to be difficult to start having those salary conversations. I'd say for new coders, you probably want to take a backseat on earning potential and a higher need or request of experience. So if there's a location that is going to give you your first level of experience as a new coder, take that. The pay is down here, but it'll start evening out. And then once you gain the experience, the pay will then become much higher. So it's definitely, if you're a new coder, it's a little bit harder to come to terms with low pay because experience is more important. Now, when it comes to an experienced coder, just address it with where you are, whether it's a staffing company and it's your recruiter. Hey, recruiter, I've worked on two jobs with you. I excelled. The third job that I go and get with you guys, I want a $2 increase because of how well I've done. And you haven't increased me the last two positions. And if it's your hiring manager, I already explained that. But if it becomes a no, by all means, go out there. You know, full-time positions primarily are more stable. So if you're a full-time employee, it's a more stable position, right? It's not where a contract's going to end on you. You just have that position indefinitely while they have that role open. You got your benefits. You have your paycheck every 2 weeks. It's more stable. But in terms of earning potential, certainly contracting, you know, your consultant work going through a staffing vendor tends to be a little bit higher, but make sure that that staffing company can also offer benefits to you. Make sure that they can offer W-2 employment options and 1099 employment options, and make sure that you speak with them about how many times they're going to have gaps in work. Do they have enough jobs to keep you busy from one project to the next? So if you're prepared to go down that path, if you're a full-time employee and the answer is no to a salary increase, take a look at going into contract work.
Okay. So are there potential drawbacks, though, to applying to a whole bunch of jobs without kind of considering what are your good fit as far as like your skills, your experience, your career goals?
So I'll say this. Well, a few things. Number one, when I have a resume for a factory worker, for example, hit my desk, you know, hi, Mr. Johnston, I know I've got skills in X, Y, and Z, manufacturing, et cetera, et cetera. Unfortunately, I delete that resume. I'll be honest with you, because I realized that that person didn't take the time to realize the roles that we staff and what my website says that I staff and what all of our job postings say that we're looking for. They don't say factory worker, you know, so we don't have that. So what you run into is when you mass apply to positions that aren't a fit, it's just a delete. That's all. It's as simple as that. They will give it 2 seconds, realize that you're nowhere even close to the industry, and they delete the resume. The other thing you should be careful with too is it's a small world in the coding space. There's only a select number of vendors. There's only a select number of hospitals and health systems that do the hiring. A lot of times they're friends of friends. Everyone's at the same conferences. You know, it's everyone's either a HEMA or AAPC credentialed. So it's a small world. So if you become an individual that mass applies in this industry for roles within coding or education or auditing, CDI, or even charge entry collections, anything along the rev cycle space that touches coding, they're more than likely to hit someone's desk, and you don't want to become known as that person that is just blanket mass producing your resume up everywhere. I still highly recommend going very specifically. And if you think, well, that's not enough, how am I going to stand out? Refer back to the first part of the video where you have to take the initiative after applying to the specific roles that match your skill set, or if they're one notch above your skill set because you're trying to improve your career, and then going out and reaching every one of those hiring managers. Requires more steps, but you're gonna beat the competition.
Yeah, and as far as jobs for a variety of skill sets, so does Weller offer a lot of different jobs for coders of various skill sets, remote, working on site, for full-time, part-time, contract, hourly paper chart? What kind of options does Waller have?
So luckily all of the above, but to be more specific, a majority of your client base here at Waller is going to be insurance company, hospital, health system, those organizations that own and operate hospitals and health systems companies. It's going to be your provider groups. And it's also going to be those AI-driven technology companies that have sold their software and are looking for staffing partners. From, you know, outside of a coding perspective, you know, you do get the collections, your accounts receivable, your accounts specialist. You will get your medical billers, your chart retrievalists, your scanners. You will see those positions. Within the coding space, you're going to see your audit and your education. You're going to see your clinical documentation improvement roles. And then into your coding, you're going to see inpatient facility, outpatient same-day surgery, ED, observation, prophy, multi-specialty, and tons of HCC risk adjustment for commercial, Medicare, Medicaid. And majority of all those are hourly positions offered on a 1099 and a W-2 basis. But a lot of our HCC roles, it's probably split half and half. Half the HCC positions are going to be hourly paid, and then half are going to be per chart. And a candidate can go W-2 or 1099, depending on what they prefer. We have both options. And we have contract roles. They can be 2 weeks or 2 year contracts. We have contract to hire positions, which means you start on a contract, and then if the hospital or client, whoever it is, likes you and you like them, there's an option to go direct with them. So you would leave us on the contract and go direct to our client. And that's the setup from the beginning. And there's also direct hire, which means organization or companies coming to us and they simply can't fill the position. So we go out and we find the individual and we send them, and they're going to work directly. So we're only here for the hiring stage. Outside of that, we also provide benefits, which I think is pretty important. So as a W-2 employee, a candidate on a contract, W-2 can earn the same benefits that myself and my entire family are on. So we also offer that at Waller too. So quite a bit, but we try to stick most of our positions within the coding umbrella.
That's amazing. I'm glad to hear that you have such a variety. And yeah, it's a lot of people ask me, you know, about the risk adjustment jobs because there's so much more involvement in there in the past, I would say even just year or two.
Yeah.
And you know, you hear a lot about, oh, is it a lot of contract work? Is it a lot of, you know, am I going to still have a job after 3 months, or is it just going to be? But it sounds like there are positions that are either more long-term contracts, or they will roll into something else, and that it can be more of a 40 hours a week full-time position, more in risk adjustment these days.
Yeah, and in the HCC space, most of the coders have two positions. And I'm going to be perfectly honest, most who are doing contract coding are going to have a 40-hour per week role. And they're going to have a 20-hour per week role. And that 20-hour a week role is going to be done in the nights and the weekends. The main role is going to be your 40-hour position. So they're definitely, as a population of candidates, are doing two positions. Yes, they can go 3 months and then end. That's kind of the scary part of contract work. My suggestion is making sure you go with an organization and stick with a recruiter there that is keeping you, really communicating with you about what's coming. So if you know it's a 3 month gig, well, when there's 1 month left, you need to start talking to your recruiter. You need to be proactive and say, there's 1 month left. What do you have? Start giving me the drip of jobs every couple of days or every week so we can start applying. Outside of that, I hate to say it, but there's a lot of good firms out there. And if you can find two or three staffing firms that you really like and that you trust and that are legitimate, and you can tell that they want to do right by you, find one or two of them. And within those, find one or two recruiters that you really like, maybe three at the most, and work with those two or three consistently. So not all your eggs are in one basket of one staffing vendor. Make sure that you have two or three. you know, we've got candidates and recruiter relationships here, but they're sending pictures, you know, oh, here's my family at Christmas, and oh, happy birthday. You know, they know the candidate's birthday. They're sending them, you know, gift cards and things. They know, you know, their Facebook friends, you know. So it's, you definitely form that relationship if you're in the contract world with a recruiter that you know and trust at a good, legit company, and do that 2 or 3 times. And that way you should never run into an instance where you're completely out of work as a contractor.
Yeah, those are awesome, awesome tips. And it sounds like Weller is definitely an excellent option for my viewers to find some work and some different roles, different experience, and have a good variety of different types of positions, experience levels, et cetera. Where can my viewers go to learn more about Weller HIT?
So you can go to wellerhit.com. It's going to be the easiest way to do it is through our website. Outside of that, you can go on Instagram, LinkedIn, and Facebook. It's all Weller HIT. You can find us anywhere there. And then you can connect with me on Facebook and LinkedIn, Kyle Johnston. It's Johnston with a T. And my email address, if anyone wants to email, is kjohnston@wellerhit.com. So definitely across all of social media, our website, and then you can reach out direct. I know a lot of the viewers that from our first video, I talked to a lot of them. So yeah, by all means, you know, I'm happy to help.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Kyle. I really appreciate your time and coming on here today to talk to us. And yeah, definitely check out Weller Healthcare IT if you are looking for a medical coding position. And Kyle will help hook you up as best he can.
Thank you.